Yes, folks. Postgame 71. Still not sure about these numbers of the episodes.
I think we got it right. I get excited sometimes when I jump us like 4 or 5 episodes ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I learned, like, I've made that problem many times over the course of my podcast producing career. And so I've grown to trust David, David's judgment, and it was wrong. I was wrong to do that. But whatever post game it is, that's good to be with you folks and join us now. Once again, returning is Rob McPherson.
How's it going?
Thanks,
Rob. Is one of the ultimate lads, Scotland's gift to the Rocky Mountains, and a good friend of mine, y'all. So it's always exciting to have him joining us on the summer stream. Thank you so much, man.
Yeah, no worries. It's always fun to be here.
Yeah, well, so tonight we should be on YouTube for you folks, but we are doing our public Twitch stream. So
yeah, no, I mean these are going to be fun. We're going to do them all throughout June, trying to juice those Twitch numbers, trying to get in on Hassan's kingdom.
We're coming. Hey, look, if we could just get one, I feel like I'm on Shark Tank. Like, if we could just get 1% of that market. We have a sustainable business. Also, you know, YouTube is fine, but I don't trust any one of these platforms. I feel like they're all going to go kerplunk at some point in a disadvantageous way for us. And so you got to diversify the portfolio.
YouTube still has a community guideline strike against us for playing a video of Steven Crowder that is still up on YouTube. For vaccine misinformation.
Oh, yeah. Which, yeah, we're never going to get that off our record.
No, we won't. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I see that every day. I'm like, geez, we're in trouble. And it's,
yeah, because it's like if people don't have one of those, like you get this big blaring thing when you log in.
Yeah. It's like, don't fuck up again. It's like, we do so much shit. We're like, honestly, like, I'm doing a better job than Fauci is, to be quite fucking frank about it. And we get dinged for a misinformation thing. Like, okay, sure. And this is all, you know, satire or whatever.
You know, disclaimer.
Yeah. I'm now already paranoid.
Yeah, you just said Fauci, so we're already working our too way far. Towards like, that second. It's
let's quickly change subjects into some.
Yeah, exactly. We got some fun stuff to get to. I mean, Daredevil's been noting this for folks. Remember that Amazon Prime members can give Left Reckoning a free Twitch subscription each month just by linking their accounts. Free money for LR at no cost to the viewer. Some good advice there, friend.
Yeah, and actually I'll be able to thank subs this time because and I know we have first-time chatter Strom McCallum on Twitch. I mean, I've seen Strom in the YouTube chat. That must mean Strom is newly added a Twitch channel that he's chatting on.
Actually, Strom, if you don't, I would just be curious, how's your how'd the launch go? I know I think we're sort of going on around the same time, but people should definitely check out Strom McCallum has a new channel on YouTube that people should be checking out.
Should do some crossover maybe. Thanks, Crandalls, for the sub as well. I feel like I'm a professional Twitch streamer.
You are in a way, Matt.
I mean, I guess I've been around the block a little bit. I've got some hype trains before.
Well, let's get some of these juices flowing. I have a video here. I played this during the stream yesterday, but I'd be curious to hear y'all's thoughts here because I think this is a really strong clip. This is Jane McAlevey, union organizing legend, talking about some of the things that they think the left needs to start getting better at when it's coming to talk about things like just transition and jobs. I went on a whole spiel on it yesterday, so I'm just going to throw it up and hear what y'all think about this.
I think that people who are doing Green New Deal work need to get quickly schooled on like what it means to have a good job and then say it. You don't just say good job because it sounds like a bunch of BS. Since the early 1970s, we have been heaving jobs. Like literally there have been like job losses year after year after year with factories moving to other parts of the world. And what people have promised, especially Democrats, by the way, is don't worry, it's going to be good for you in the end. We're creating a lot of jobs in America. And what they don't say, but what workers know, is that the jobs that they're creating are crap jobs. with very low standards, with little to no benefits, without the kind of defined benefit pension that people used to have. We hear a lot of talk connected to the Green New Deal about good jobs. And people are just sort of saying, oh, we need to have good jobs. No one's actually defining that. And there's several things that I think people have to do all the time starting now. One is, it's not saying good jobs. It's saying trade union, union organized jobs that hold, match, meet the exact standards that workers in the fossil fuel industry are currently earning. If you look at the states that sadly were won by Donald Trump on the margins in 2016, it's the states where workers were promised, don't worry, there'll be good jobs for you when your factory goes out of the country. That's no different than when Green New Dealers say, don't worry, when we end the actually high-paying unionized with good benefits, like substantial health care and retirement benefits, don't worry, there'll be good jobs for you. We'll offer job retraining. We'll create jobs. American workers have been hearing that for about 45 years, and frankly, it's a bold-faced lie. That's not to say I'm not 1,000% behind the Green New Deal. That is why I'm at this conference. I worked in the environmental movement for a decade before I went into the trade union movement. I'm also really frustrated by the lack of clarity about how the policies are addressed, like how people talk about good jobs. Stop saying it. Like, be very specific. We have to hold the standard. To do that, we have to shift the subsidies. That takes tremendous power. That's what has to happen as part of the Green New Deal discussion.
Pretty convincing case right there.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
You know, I mean, I'm definitely buy it. I love everything Jane says there, but like the problem is, it's like, how do you credibly talk about that in a after like this much Joe Biden, right? Yeah. Like, right? Like, it's.
I mean, before we even get to like Biden and the Democrats, I think it's something that we need to get a lot better on the left. Like yesterday I was talking about the fact that, you know, the workers who are in like the oil and gas industry here in Texas have been under siege by their employers for, you know, for years. But most explicitly in recent memory, the past couple of years where, you know, you saw something like near 150,000 jobs lost in Texas in the oil and gas industry at the height of the pandemic, right? Beaumont, Texas, 10-month lockout there. Like, these are real immediate fights. And, you know, I what I was saying yesterday, Matt, and I'm curious what you think about this too, Rob, but I was remembering how stoked we all were, Matt, when we did our Chicago live show. Because when we flew to Chicago, it was right when Bernie, like, put out the Green New Deal plan, and you know, it was a very detailed plan, and particularly like the Just Transition, I think, really captured all of our interests and Michael's as well. And you know, just like a little bit of you know, reflection, was realizing that, look, well, that needed to go a hell of a lot further than just like a slogan and actually start to become a commitment. And you still see a lot of people on the left who are extremely squeamish about showing up for people who are fighting for their lives in those industry. And it's just sort of like, you know, if you're not showing up for people now, how do you expect them to trust you that you're going to be showing up to for them in 5-10 years when you're talking about changing, you know, the way that we, you know, fuel and electrify our society, and you know, you're not even there now. Like, how, why would they believe you when you say, oh, well, you're going to have a good job. Oh, don't worry, we got you, right? When, as Jane says, like, your entire life, if you've been a worker in this country, has just been whenever politics comes into your life, it means things are about to get a lot worse, not better. And I think that's a real serious challenge. Like the at least for our audience, like, I'm not as worried about what's the Democratic Party doing. I think it matters, but you know, it's not the thing that I'm thinking about the most. But this question of, you know, when we say, oh, just transition, you're going to have a good job, like really trying to lay that out and showing people that we have the capacity and the capability to be able to deliver that.
Well, and like, I guess, how, if someone's like, I'm skeptical that you have the capacity to do that. Like, you, I guess McAlevey points out, you know, you shift subsidies, a big part of it, right? I mean, that's really it. The government needs to subsidize the jobs that it wants to see.
But I mean, you know, like, look at the problems with the green industry right now. I mean, like, those jobs do not pay very well. They're hyper exploitative. And as, you know, Fred Stafford and Matt Huber point out, you know, that industry has gotten incredible carve outs to prevent any government competition against, you know, green energy. Right. And like, that's a dynamic that we should actually be very worried about and concerned about, because, yeah, it was the Republicans who led that, but the Democrats are very happy to acquiesce. And that's, you know, that's something that is very serious. If we're talking about, we're going to move our energy production to that industry, and that industry is rife with these problems. Not that those problems don't exist in, you know, fossil fuels. But, you know, it just shows, I think, a lot of people on the left have been so fixated on the, we need to do something about climate change, or do you believe in climate change? Like, that's been the parameters of the debate, that there hasn't been enough investigation for people who are advocates for this kind of thing about what that transition actually might look like.
Yeah.
This issue hits kind of close to home for me, because my entire family, they're all from like rural southeastern Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, that whole area. And most of them have made their entire livelihoods on the oil and gas industry. Like, they've been working in the fields as roughnecks or wellhead engineers or like in that world for the last 30 years. And recently, in the last 15, 20 years, these jobs have been going away. And what that's led to is a lot of economic anxiety. And it's pushed a lot of those people further into the right. Because what they hear on national TV is they hear people like Trump going out and saying, oh, we're going to bring gas back to this country. We're going to produce domestic gas. And so you end up with these people, you know, voting in what they think is their own self-perceived economic interests. And it's driving a wedge between people that could be, like she asked, is these could be good union paying jobs in a green sector that would be sustainable, that we could have for the future, that wouldn't be causing this existential crisis that we face as a people. But it's tough to convince these people of something different when there's very few offers, it seems like, on the table for them to have like sustaining high paying, because a lot of them made a lot of money doing this work, you know, high paying jobs in this new sector. It's tough.
Yeah, I mean, when I was looking for a job after graduating at NYU, I was very, very tempted to go back to the oil field. Even like I'd read plenty of, I was like ideologically left at that point, and like, of course I would go take $120, get a driver's truck driving license, and you know, go up roads that I've been up like, frankly, dozens and dozens of times anyway. People don't really think about that. How decisive that problem is. And that's the same thing with like border communities, David. Like, how, that's $100,000 job.
Yeah.
Enforcing the border, right? Like, and people, that's politics, right? That immediately impacts the politics.
But what's annoying about it is like, that's the politics that we should be winning.
Yeah.
What I mean? Like, good, like the left, like the pro worker left. Like, we should be able to win, like, good job, good income, take care of your family stuff. And yeah, unfortunately, the situation right now is it's not the case at all.
Yeah, I mean, no, it's wiped off the playing field. It's theoretical. It exists in the minds of like Ben Shapiro and Stephen Crowder. When they look at the Democrats, they see like a party that actually is equipped or like willing to speak to those issues. But that doesn't exist. Like, look at the Build Back Better thing. Joe Manchin killed that thing, and we had a charade for an entire summer about it, even though he already agreed. Like, and that was at a certain point. There's a book, a Harvard University Press psychology book called "Strangers to Ourselves" by a guy named Timothy Wilson, I think. And the basic idea is this: look at your behavior. Don't all the stuff, all the rationalizations in your mind for different things that you're doing, and even what you're telling yourself, let alone like you lying to other people about your motives, you tell yourself lies too. Look at what you're actually doing. At a certain point, like, what is America actually doing? And it's doing exactly what it's fucking like set up to do. And so all the campaign bluster is just bluster. And it's pretty wild to see how fucking durable that is.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, like, maybe so we can open up to some other topics. This might be a segue, but, like, I think that, like, one of the bigger criticisms is, like, look, you know, Matt and I were professional politics talkers, right? You know, we tell people, like, this is how you should frame the argument, this is how you should think about the argument. But I think too much of our movement right now is really fixated on like trying to win the argument and are actually missing like the material part of politics, which is like building coalitions that have the capacity and the capability of winning and implementing some of these things. And until you start to take that challenge more seriously, then it's just like you as an individual, like dunking on like your right wing friend. Right. And it's like, That's fun. It's interesting. And some on like some large scale, maybe that moves the dial forward one way or the other. But like at this point, especially when it comes to climate change, like we need to get serious and rooted, and we need to do that really, really fast.
There's not a lot of time left to, you know, play those games. It's getting serious. It's getting bad quick. Look at Yellowstone this week. If you've seen the images of the flooding that's going on up there, I mean, it's
you got flood in there, and then you have Odessa, Texas, where 165,000 people have been without water. Right. Yeah. I mean, that's like the dynamic that we're in.
And that's another, water is another problem up in Yellowstone. Their water intake is swamped with silt and shit, and apparently they got a day of water left. And it's look at all like the luxury and affluence and like every community. Yeah, my hometown, there's a certain sector of town on the Missouri River that's like fucking mini Dubai on the Missouri, where they're carving in canals and like so they can put like $1 million homes on it. We have, and it's just like all this production going towards increasing affluence for a smaller and smaller number of people as society crumbles. I mean, to be fair to my hometown, Mandan, they did invest in a new water treatment plant prior to COVID that allowed them to track people's poop really well. So that's big. But anyway,
nice.
Also, reminding folks, you know, this is interactive, so feel free to jump into the chat with question comments. Our friend Sean McCallum in South Carolina says, "I got Bucky's barbecue today. May Comrade Griscom forgive me." Well, also, I don't think Bucky's is necessarily bad, but it's just like fast food barbecue, which is like I just put in a different category. It does make me feel very weird to see Bucky's going national like it has. Rob, have you ever been to Bucky's when you've been in Texas?
I've never been to Bucky's. I'd never heard of that one either. That's a completely new...
Well, you've
never
heard of Bucky's before?
No, and I've spent a lot of time in both Carolinas.
Bucky's are like stupid big gas stations. Like, I'm talking like 2-3 football fields big.
Okay. Like it's like Love's, if you've ever been. Love's.
It's not like... It's like Love's is like a cheap knockoff Bucky's. I'm just saying like the grandeur of like of a Bucky's is extreme. Like, when you go in to piss, like, they have very clean bathrooms, and they'll have like $300, like, huge portraits of like buffalo and cowboys and stuff like that, like in the bathroom. Like, you're just constantly...
I love this place, dude.
You know, we should go next time.
This is the vibe, man. That sounds awesome.
That just reminded me, there's this place that used to be in fucking Mandan, my hometown, called Bonanza, and they knocked it down and put up a Culver's. But there used to be this dining area in the back that just had the biggest sort of plains mural of like antelope and like different things. I like that sort of you don't see that in New York. Is too cool for stuff like
they
that.
They don't do that at all. If you go to any gas station or fast food place in Kansas, it's just John Brown with like two rifles like screaming at a tornado everywhere.
That's
you go.
Badass,
it's the greatest,
dude.
That's fucking
everywhere you go, awesome. You just get hype. Yeah.
That's the best argument I've ever heard for moving to Kansas.
That's the only argument for moving to Kansas. Otherwise, it's just atrocious.
They opened a location in Florence, South Carolina, very close to where
I was. I took Florence to mean the other Florence, but okay.
Oh, okay. That'd be in Florence, Italy.
In Florence, Italy.
Henry Mick's slave master, Henry McMaster, made a big spectacle out of the grand opening. Yeah, it's just like, I don't know. It's funny, like, we got too much stuff to go on these kind of tirades, but like, it is weird for me, like Whataburger, they're talking about like making that national, and like, I'm all about like cultural intermingling, but there is something that happens when those kind of regional brands start becoming national. They lose a lot of like their local flavor very quickly.
Yeah.
I don't trust people in South Carolina to make good brisket, friends. Well, on this, while we're on this, so he says, ball player of some sort, does any good grilling recently? Did some kebabs tonight. Nothing better than charred meat and veggies on a stick. I totally agree. Well, my big project, you know, my fiance is Iranian, and if you haven't had like Iranian kebab, which is not like the Turkish shish kebab. Sorry, I'm already coming at the questioner.
This is getting heated already. I can tell.
But it's just like, it's just like, if you've had like real Iranian kebab, it's just something out of this world. And I'm getting the swords because you grill on a sword over coals, like over wood fire. I'm getting ready for that. I'm working my way up. I want to impress the family. So that's my big plan. That and, you know, just classic stuff. I mean, both of y'all have had my barbecue. I'm not too bad at it.
No, it was one of the most incredible things I think I've ever had. Yeah. I still also, just show strangers pictures of it.
I roast tea cup. Thanks for subscribing at tier one.
We certainly appreciate that.
Exactly.
Well, let's do some more sound. How about that?
Well, yeah. Do you have sound? I have some. I have some Twitter stuff. And look, I imagine we'll be discussing the Myra Flores stuff in greater depth. So I don't want to get a suit. Oh man, don't talk about chicken kebabs with basmati rice. There's a place in Brooklyn that.
Dude, Jujay kebab. Yeah,
man, I'm hungry now.
okay, Matt and I are just like trying to see, like test the water, see if we could just pivot to just being like a food show.
Mukbangs. Yeah,
this is true. Exactly. But you don't cook any food, you just discuss how good it is.
We review it.
Oh, that's so good.
Things that I like. It.
Okay, sorry. Matt was setting something up and we like derailed him completely.
But okay. So yeah, I don't want to get suicide tracked into the Myra Flores of all this, but there's a Twitter exchange between Glenn Greenwald and Jamal Bowman. Not an exchange. Glenn retweeted something Jamal Bowman said about Elon Musk is not a leader. He's just another Republican billionaire who supports white supremacy and authoritarianism because he doesn't want his workers to unionize or pay their fair share in taxes. Greenwald took issue with this, saying you know, she can't be white supremacist because she was born in Mexico, which I think I'll just quick sidebar. It was news to me, I would say, like when I was like 18 or something, that you could have white supremacists born in Mexico. Mexico is a product of European settlement, like the United States is. And there's, if you look at, for instance, the show like Made in Mexico or Hecho en México on Netflix, a lot of those people look very white. So colorism particularly and like sort of white supremacy can't exist in that. I won't say too specifically on this candidate. I heard she's like QAnon-y or Jan 6-y. But anyways, what we're talking about is this. Christina Pucha responded. Christina Pucha is Ron DeSantis' spokesperson. She says, unlike most Americans, Elon grew up in a place with literal white supremacy, apartheid South Africa, and by all accounts, he actively opposed that regime. That's why he cares about free speech today. He has seen it from the other side. Not that Bowman and his squad would get it. I mean,
my God.
So now there are some accounts of Elon Musk, a theory as to how Elon might have actively, we have a really good source as to, you know, definitive, but there's a few theories thrown around as to like what if there is a source for him actively you know, resisting apartheid, what does that look like? This is from Perform Policy magazine. The biggest reason was likely to avoid military service in South Africa, then still in the grip of apartheid. Musk says suppressing black people just didn't seem like a really good way to spend time. Now that is hardly, to me, you know, Mandela. That seems like it doesn't seem profitable. this is a question of time investment. So that's one theory. But we actually can go to the man's mother herself.
This would be good.
I did not know she was on Twitter, but her name is Mae Musk, Maye, and Mae came on to defend Elon from back when he was going to by Twitter, the Times said, you know, he said this tweet, Elon Musk grew up in elite white communities in South Africa, detached from apartheid's atrocities and surrounded by anti-black propaganda. That seems all entirely plausible to me. he sees his takeover of Twitter as a free speech win, but in his youth did not suffer the effects of misinformation. Now, his mom, bless mothers, I don't know if she kind of gets the whole point, but she says, in South Africa, if you publicly opposed apartheid, you went to jail. This, therefore, Elon Musk did not publicly oppose apartheid. He didn't do anything. She goes on to say, in Russia, if you publicly oppose the war, you go to jail. New York Times, they're going to blame children for decisions made by governments. I think like the response to that is, well, if there's a child in Russia right now and they're not saying anything about the invasion and maybe they're even supporting it, and then 20, 30 years later, they have a factory and it's getting sued because there's such a violently anti-Ukrainian culture there, Ukraine-hating culture that is getting sued for it. Then I'd be like, you know what? Maybe the Russia stuff does have something to do with it. But yeah, Elon Musk's mom says didn't oppose apartheid. So,
well, also like let's not forget why Musk moved his companies to Texas is because his plants in California are being actively investigated for what Matt and I have just called extreme racism. I mean, there's just like you read a lot of these things. It's like, well, that's horrible, and you know, then it sort of makes it difficult to express properly how horrific the allegations that were coming out of the Fremont plant in California were against Musk. You know, they were segregating workers by race. They were making black workers do like the most physically difficult tasks, and they segregated them to a very specific part of the workplace that they called, quote, the plantation, along with other extremely derogatory names. Like, that's the kind of company that this guy is running. So I think it's very, very fair you know, to throw some of these allegations at Musk because that's the way that he's governed his company straight up.
Yeah. Yeah. It really is. Like, it's not one of these, like, there is, if you'd say like racist CEO or racist head of business, Elon Musk comes to mind at this point. Like,
totally.
Like, yeah. 100%. Yeah.
Which, I mean, it's straight up like mask off moment for Musk, which is, it's not like a big revelation for us, but maybe the general public. I mean, you know, like the thing that's so funny about Glenn, and like I think for the most part, I've actually tried to steer clear of doing too much Glenn stuff on the program because I don't know what's going on there. But the argument that Glenn Greenwald makes here about Flores, it's like it's such a funny misrepresentation of what Bowman said up front. Bowman said that Musk is a white supremacist authoritarian supporter, right? Not that like Maya Flores necessarily is a white supremacist, right? Which not saying that you know, because some people will make those arguments by anyone who's on the right. I think that like a lot of people on the left like might need to get a little bit of like cultural education about like what South Texas is like, because there is this kind of like, I don't know, overdetermination of like race and ethnicity with people on the left. And we'll talk about that actually in just like probably 2 minutes from now.
And that's what they're exploiting, right? Yeah.
And that's also what the GOP is exploiting. And what's just funny to me about Glenn here, and again, we'll focus on the South Texas race just right after this. Like, what's funny about Glenn when he does this kind of thing is that Glenn is like, oh, I'm, you know, I'm looking in between the lines. I'm really analyzing these things and cutting through the bullshit. And like, again, if Bowman had said that voting for Flores was being a white supremacist, I would probably even take issue with that and push back on that a little bit, right? But that's not what Bowman says. Nor, and then what Glenn does is like take it to another level where he is now feeding into the fucking bullshit GOP thing, which is why they're promoting somebody like Flores in the first place, to be like, look, we have somebody on our side who is not a white woman, you know, so like you can't call us racist anymore for the kind of bullshit that we're doing at the border. You can't call us racist anymore for the demonization of, you know, Mexican American and Latin American folks in the country, right? Like, that's what they're doing. And Glenn has like such a bullshit detector right now for the left that he just completely throws in the trash whenever he wants to talk about the right wing. And yeah. I don't know, it's pretty amazing to watch.
Well, it's impressive. Yeah, and just because we have avoided talking about it, but I do want to bring back this tweet about Christian Walker. It's just like, You can't talk about identity politics and then tweet out this. Herschel Walker's son, Christian, is a black, gay, young, very smart, and very independent-minded, and he's going to be driving liberals absolutely crazy for a long time to come. And, like, honestly, like, Christian Walker is pretty loathsome, but he's like a fucking kid. And, like, to get thrown up as this independent-minded person when he's really just parroting GOP bullshit and basically helping stoke a panic against gay people in this country, it sucks.
Well, let's go to this race in South Texas, because it is like,
I'm curious what you think about this.
You know what I think about this. I mean, this is like, this is a real disaster for the Democratic Party, right? So Myra Flores won this special election, and I could see as it was starting to percolate that it was looking like it might be a close race. That the Democratic Party, instead of spending their time actually trying to win the special election, was setting themselves up to convince their base that it's not a big deal that they're going to lose it. So the National Party virtually put like no money. They did some like digital ad buys day of. So like if you're reading local news, you got like a little like advertisement, nothing compared to the machine that the GOP set up in that part of Texas going to the special election. And since then, the Democrats have been saying, you know, a couple different things. One, well, this district will only exist for 6 months, so we don't care about it. And two, in the upcoming November election, we're destined to win. And I just find it despicable for a party that we now know for a fact was propping up Donald Trump in the 2016 Republican primaries to sit here and be like, oh, well, we're doing big brain moves here. We're going to let these folks, you know. We're just going to let these people create a new political figure and lightning rod for themselves in South Texas. Somebody who can dispel some of like the liberal fantasies about what people think in this part of the country about politics. We're just going to let this person get this huge persona and media attention and all of this because we just know we'll be able to beat them in the future. I mean, you're playing with fire, and I'm not going to make any bold predictions that they'll necessarily lose in November. Maybe they're right, but it's an extremely fucking dangerous game to be playing.
Yeah, there's no reason. It's a ridiculous risk to take it to begin with. You know, they think they're playing 4D chess, but it's just makes no sense.
And it goes bravado. To this.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I want to say is, like, it also, it soaks, it's either a malicious, like, neglect, like, the way that the Democratic Party would rather run Amy McGrath than Booker in Kentucky. Yeah. And, right, and it's like, who gives a fuck, if who can win, right? Because running a race, like, that sets messaging up for the future races too, and you like build infrastructure and that sort of thing. And it's like, and so what this does is like, who gives a fuck if she loses? She's going to be set up. That's going to be a whole political operation now.
Yeah.
And
they made inroads.
And it's going to get a whole bunch of fucking money because Jesus Christ, if you're a Republican donor, like you bust out the big, like your biggest check, the fucking publisher's clearinghouse check, to send down there. For the type of value, like you just see the propaganda value, like Christina Pusha, Ron DeSantis' spokesperson is talking about that shit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and it just shows, like, obviously this is, you know, my home state, so I follow these things pretty closely. But it goes back to something that I know some people who watch the show a lot might be tired of me mentioning time and time again, but it's just the Democratic Party takes people of color for granted as a voting bloc, particularly South Texan Tejanos and Hispanics. Like, they do not care about that group of people. They think that those people are locked in with them forever. And what is happening right now is that you're seeing the Republicans and the GOP, despite all of the bullshit that they're doing, being able to claw and move people over to their side. And I don't think people recognize how dangerous this shit could get. Like, not even far off anymore, right? Like, right now, this is, like, happening right in front of us. You know, I'm going to play this clip here just to re-up the fact that I've been talking about this for a while. People, please forgive me. It was a tough time.
Oh, stop being so hard on yourself.
I look very hungover in this video. But this is me after Biden won, talking about the disastrous results that Biden had in Texas.
So what was the suburban strategy? You know, for the Democratic Party, the suburbs are really becoming their home, and that's really not a good thing. In their now decades-long pivot towards affluent voters instead of fighting for working-class voters, the Democratic Party is pushing for politics that address the class interests of the upper middle class instead of fighting for working people. And what we saw in Texas in this most recent election, there is a definite ceiling in how much support they can win from these suburban voters. And it's not worth ignoring working-class people to get those votes. Put simply, it's just not a path to victory, and the consequences of that kind of politics are dire. Let's look at what happened in the Texas border region. It needs to be noted so nobody gets the wrong impression. The Democrats won this part of the state, but their margins were very, very small. And when you tally all the votes statewide, that cut into Biden's possibility of being able to take the state. Across 28 counties in South Texas, Biden won by only 17 points. Just to put this into context, in 2016, Hillary Clinton was able to win this region by 33 points. In the Rio Grande Valley, it was even worse. Joe Biden only won by 15 points in areas where Hillary Clinton won by 39%. In Zapata County, which is just a bit north of the valley, Trump was able to carry the county by 5 points. In a county that Hillary Clinton won by 33 points in 2016, and Barack Obama won by 43% in 2012. That's a huge drop. And this was a completely avoidable result. One that the Biden campaign and the National Democratic Party and the State Democratic Party had been getting warnings about for a very long time.
And just to follow up there, you can watch the whole video if you want. It's a good video. Thanks, Cale Brooks, for putting those together, by the way. Socialism can win in Texas. You can find it on Jacobin's YouTube channel. But the warnings were very clear. So I noted there Jessica Cisneros and other activists who were literally like warning the Democratic Party, something is happening in South Texas. There is a mobilization for the right wing that you guys need to counteract. And the what you got from the National Democratic Party is like, oh, well, no, those people will never turn their backs on us, despite the fact that it's been happening every presidential election cycle since Obama. In this situation here with Myra Flores, on Tuesday night, this is from the Texas Tribune, on Tuesday night, Flores most notably carried Cameron County, the most populous county in the district and a longtime Democratic stronghold along the Mexican border. She defeated Sanchez, the Democratic candidate there, thereby a percentage point after Biden carried the county by 13 points in 2020. It should also be noted that this is the county right on the border by Matamoros and Brownsville, where Musk is now ramping up his kind of operations here, right? There is a fire happening in South Texas right now, and the Democratic Party on the national level certainly, but I also have to say state level too, is sleepwalking into something that would be absolutely disastrous. Like, let's just take off the presidential map for a second, because that seems to be the only thing that you can get the attention of the fucking Democratic Party with. What that means for people in Texas as we continue to see this virulent right-wing movement continue to attack people's basic human rights, you want to start creating political situations where Republicans can start winning, you know, significant seats in that part of the state, right? You are condemning people to generations of right-wing tyranny under that, right? Yeah. And it's just this sleepwalking BS, pseudo-woke kind of like demographics is destiny. Well, oh, people of color will always show up for us Democrats because, you know, we present ourselves in a certain way. And the fact is, you have to show up for people on a basic material level and show that you care about them. And the Democratic Party is completely incapable of doing that right now, which is abysmal when you think about how horrific the fucking the Republican Party should never be able to beat you on bread and butter issues. But they do, because the Democratic Party has no real interest in doing anything other than trying to push this BS suburban politics narrative. And, you know, somebody like Abrams, right, who, yes, did a lot of great organizing work in Georgia, is a very, very dangerous precedent for the way that the Democratic Party is trying to go, because that's what they want to do. Like the way that they were able to win those Senate seats in Georgia, they got a huge turnout from, you know, wealthy suburban voters. And they're doing the same thing in Texas, outside Dallas, Houston, Austin, San Antonio, etc. Right. The thing is, those people aren't loyal. the vast majority of the people who in 2020 flipped from Republican to Democrat voted Republican down ballot. And two, that's not the kind of coalition that's going to be able to build a winning movement for any of these kind of, like, drop Bernie Sanders stuff for a second. Just like Joe Biden's, like, very limp, let's return to some level of government spending for working people program. Those people aren't going to show up for that either. And you're just handing the fucking Republicans this stuff because you think you're too smart for politics now. We're going to let them spend a lot of money just propping up this national candidate now, you know, because it's a sure thing that we're going to win. Absolutely psychotic and dangerous, frankly.
What should be the policy response? Because, you know, there was that Alex Salmon article in American Prospect about the stations GOP was setting up to recruit people, but it's bigger than that, right? I do think, like, the caller also mentioned the just like the Republicans are investing in that community, frankly,
yes,
with border stuff, right? Like that, just that's money. And so, like, what there needs to be a countervailing offer, and like, what is that?
Totally. And like, Myra Flores, you know, is married to a Border Patrol agent, right? You know, and all, again, when people, they're not familiar with the area, they don't get it, they don't understand how people feel in those communities. They think that it's going to be a one-to-one versus, I don't know how folks feel maybe in New York City, you know, who are like of Hispanic origin. It's not the same in South Texas. And, you know, you can criticize it, you can push back against that kind of stuff that, like, is very pro Border Patrol that's going on there. But as Matt was saying, you got to remember that a lot of that support comes from the fact that those are decently paying jobs in areas where you don't have decently paying jobs for most people. I mean, the policy solution is, you can, like, to put like a reasonable thing for the Democratic Party, child tax credit, basic kind of Green New Deal infrastructure programs that we desperately need all across the country that provide permanent real jobs for people. Run on that, win on that, instead of this kind of nonsense, you know, very vague, oh, we don't like how mean the Republicans are these days, and we should go back to like a era of nice governance. But in this context, you can't even talk about juxtaposing those two visions because the fucking Democratic Party didn't even put up a vision. Like, they didn't even fund the ability to put up even that kind of, like, oh, we're the politicians of respectability, you know? They didn't even do that there. They just straight up said, oh, we're not worried about this part of the country. And people feel that. When all they're seeing is ads from the Republican side, it's less even about how convincing the ads are. It's like, oh, these, you know, there's attention being paid to me as a voter to try to win my vote. And you got to show up.
Yeah, I'm curious, Dave, because I don't know very much about, you know, the race per se, but I'm wondering, like, do they know what the prevailing issues were? Did they do exit polling on, like, why people voted the way that they did in this race? Like, what was the driving force for people going in that direction?
So, you know, I think it might be early, at least from what I've seen, to get any good exit polling data out. But just going back to 2020, when you started to see Republican wins in that part of the state, you know what a lot of the people said? People said they were worried about crime. People said they were worried about immigration. But a lot of people also said, you know, that guy Trump sent me $1,200. That really helped me and my family out of a pickle. Yeah. And, you know, we can again be like, oh, you know, the Democrats actually were violent, blah, blah, blah. It was like, then fucking run on it, man. Like, no, there's no doubt about it that it's like wanting to have more security for yourself and your family and a future is a winning issue. It's a winning issue everywhere, frankly. And all we've seen from the fucking the Democratic Party since they've come in office has been, I mean, literally, like, what we get from Biden these days, apart from him just vague tweeting, like, these times have never been more crazy and dangerous than they are right now, which would make you think that he's not the president of the United States, is like this stuff like, we're going to let the Federal Reserve do their job and we're going to step out of the way, right? It's like, we want technocrats to come back into power and not do politics anymore, right? That's just not a winning message. Like, the person who gets excited when Biden says, I'm going to respect the Federal Reserve's, independence from politics is a little freak and is also not the vast majority of voters in the United States.
Yeah. And also probably wants you to cancel their fucking student loan debt and gives a little bit less of a shit about the Fed because they definitely probably took out student loans.
I think that's a good point.
I have some sub thanks to do before we go some calls. Mulch sure. Turtle, thanks for the sub. JJ Fly, Pod Buffet, and Dirt Devil gifted sub. Thank you all for contributing to our Twitch endeavors. First call here from, I believe it's from Dave from Jamaica. We'll see.
You, Dave from Jamaica, love the new voicemail. So, I don't know if you picked this up last time because I was out, but I will make it nice and quick and probably add a little more flourish to it. As we talk about renewables, right, the issue at hand is, and this is from my perspective, right, renewables like solar, thermal, you know, hydroelectric, depending on where you live. I'll use Texas and California for examples. I do see the renewables being able to provide the energy they need without the use of nuclear, because at the end of the day, nuclear takes a long time to set up, so it's not really a good transitional thing. And of course, you know the dangers. The issue at hand with renewables is a lot of them are not very labor intensive, so you don't need much labor to keep them going. And that's going to be a problem, as you guys brought up, with the Green New Deal. There are, as you rightly said, there ain't many jobs in that. And my solution, I don't know if it will happen, but probably needs to happen, is a true just transition in my mind is, especially with renewables that are safe, like the solar thermal stuff, is that it cannot be a profit-making thing. Basically, it has to be kind of like a public good. In other words, if people get, it's like a government investment. In other words, if they build the solar thermal, the most people do is pay for it through taxes. And as in return, you know, you get free electricity. I think that's the only way to sell it. As long as the profit motive drives it, there's going to be problems. And of course, we need to come off fossil fuels or... There is no future, point blank. So at least that's my view of it. I think a good just transition, in my opinion, is once the renewables are set up and there'll be jobs, especially with big things like solar thermal plant or something like that, is that there's a lot of jobs in the setup because it takes a while. It's a big investment to construct. But outside of that... It has to be free. The products of that investment has to be free to its citizens. At least that's my view of it. I wonder what you guys think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to go on this, but I feel like I go on these a lot, so I'd be happy to give you all a take on it first.
No, I was going to make way for you, actually.
Well, I mean... First on regarding nuclear, I mean, like, one of the biggest threats to any kind of real transition has been this war on nuclear. Fred Stafford has a really phenomenal piece in the most recent Jacobin Magazine print edition, how liberals created then destroyed publicly owned nuclear power. And he's talking about the closing of New York's Indian Point plant, which, you know, provided incredible amounts of electricity to New York City, was attacked by this kind of, you know, I can't call them, by this like green movement. And now New York City is now having to rely on dirty fuels to power the city. I mean, just an absolute disaster of something that was set up, provided incredible union jobs for people, and, you know, has been taken away. And on the nuclear thing, we're going to have Lee Phillips on the program next week, I'm hoping, to sort of break down the why it's good, how it can be created, and the importance of nuclear in the transition. So I'll tease that for the future. But to the second bit, because I'll just say I've just been completely convinced on that. But on the second bit, on like we have to make these things, you know, free for people. We need to be making these things affordable, and, you know, I would prefer to decommodify these things entirely if we're able to do that in a transitionary phase. It might be a little bit before we're able to get it perfectly, but, you know, look at the example of like the TVA in this country. the TVA was nothing short of like a world historic move. It electrified the South. It created incredible union jobs. And also it had effects even outside of the direct energy sector, right? From, you know, from the churches where they were having people, you know, preach at. Like all this stuff was centrally planned and was designed to be able to meet the needs of the communities and the workers who were providing this power. That's the model, I think. Nothing short of that is like New Deal style, centrally planned growth of these industries. The biggest hurdle that we have right now toward renewables is the fact, as we laid out earlier in this episode, that the way that these things have been set up now is trying to preclude any kind of government competition to them, right? That's fucking really dangerous to being able to make these things successful, right? And, you know, again, we'll talk more about this technically next week with Lee Phillips about some of the problems with intermittency, with things like solar and wind, which are real things. And I don't say this to just poo-poo, and I really don't. I would wish that it was just like an easy flip switch that we could play. But we're talking about complex systems that are riddled with problems. Don't get me wrong, but they're complex systems. And we're not just going to be able to just like, you know, flip a switch and move to one or the other immediately, right? These things need to be planned out, and we need to be taking social control of these things if we want these to be successful. So I totally agree. Any kind of like major costs need to be going to be like the way that electricity and stuff like this works in this country, I think is a good example of this is like, look at the energy industry in Texas, right? When the energy industry fails, they get bailed out and they get protected by the state, right? But their profits are private. Right. So it's like social cost, private gain. And no, we can't do that with any kind of real transition here.
No, I agree with everything that you just said. And I think, you know, the nuclear thing is kind of a soft subject for me because I get really upset every time I talk about it. But even look at like what's happening in the world today, right? Like when Germany reduced all of their nuclear power and then yes. they sent all of their, you know, start importing all the natural gas from Russia, and then it leads to where we are now today in this world.
Sorry, not cutting you off. I'm just saying, Germany is like a huge counter argument to like what happens when you denuclearize your energy system.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, that's. I still have certain concerns over sourcing and waste, but as far as like practicality and having a you know, a shot clock on this thing. And needing to decarbonize, it seems insane to be taking any capacity offline. I am still concerned about like the ramp up time, and that's a question I'm going to put to Lee is like,
and I think that's the most important question.
And it's like that's a state question, right? The government could fucking do this. They could do thorium, maybe. Like there's things like if the government just wanted to fucking do it. It could do it. But, you know, you have all sorts of interests that are against that.
Just because I know you love this, Matt, but like the model is here. It's like TVA. It's like New Deal style programs for doing this transition. And it's nothing. It's like it's not even that like crazy of an analogy, right? If that's, you know, getting us out of the Great Depression and, you know, restarting the economy during the war, right? I mean, this is the same kind of like engagement that we need to be facing with the question of climate change. And like, we actually like, we don't have to like, I mean, I wouldn't be against it. You know, cite Lenin's line on what is communism. Communism is Soviet power and electricity, right? Like we actually have like a homegrown example that was very beneficial for people in this country that we should be expanding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Dirt Devil in the chat says, how about a GI program that allows fossil fuel workers to go to college for free so they can pursue a job in any career they choose? Maybe they didn't want to be in energy to begin with. I'm not saying this is the only thing we can do for. And I know, so I'm going to say no to that for a couple reasons. One, this is the stuff that Biden and Obama push all the time. When when they were I remember this because I was working in media and I had to watch a lot of really boring press conferences. I remember when Biden was vice president, he goes to West Virginia and their whole plan was they were going to let coal workers go and learn to code at community colleges for free. Like that was their big push, right? And you see, one, that's not politically like exciting for people. And two, it really misses the fact, right? So we're not going to give you any kind of security. We're going to give you the same promise that we give to the youth in this country, which is not a promise. I think the vast majority of people who are watching this show know how much weight a college degree gets you when it comes to careers. You know, it's not a real solution to this kind of thing. The just transition that Bernie Sanders laid out was that people, the union workers who are working in that industry, and it was included not just union, but they were trying to encourage unionization as a part of this, they would get guaranteed income equal to their income today. For a period of, I think it was like 3 to 4 years. And during that transition period, the unions were supposed to be leading the transition so that all those people were getting rehired in different forms of renewable energy, right? That's just much more viable and real than, oh yeah, we'll let you get a piece of paper from some school down the road for, and you don't have to pay for it. That's not security. I mean, yeah. You know, especially if you're like, you know, in a certain period of your life where you have like a lot of financial responsibilities, like a family, children, right? You don't want to say, I'm going back to school and I hope that maybe I can get a nice job on the other side of it. Like, that's just not a winning formula.
Well, it's also the certification doesn't matter if the infrastructure doesn't exist either, right?
That's
so if they're not actually building these projects on a massive scale where they require labor to go and do these jobs, then the idea of just getting education to go learn how to do something, I mean, it's a great idea, but it's not practical unless they're actually making these projects, you know?
Well, and it's like, what are the leaders of the economy preoccupied with not now? It's not giving people another option in the workplace so they can leave the job that currently sucks ass, right?
Oh, like, they're trying to drive wages down. Did you see Jerome Powell last week was talking about how we're overinflating the economy because workers are making too much money right now. So we got to raise. Yeah, they're trying to jack up interest rates. They're trying to jack up, you know, all, I don't know. And they're lowering
their balance sheet. Yeah, no, they're creating a lot of crises there. And again, like the whole learn to code thing, like, you know, everyone's like, oh, well, wow, Facebook is investing in, you know, marginalized communities so that they can learn to code. That job made a lot of money in the early days because it was rare, right? And why is Facebook and all those companies investing in it? It's not out of the sweetness of their heart. It's because they want a reserve army of labor so that they can draw the wages down in their own fucking industry.
Right? That's exactly what it is. They have to pay these people way too much money to do like an 8-hour labor job. You're sitting there, you know, writing these lines of code. And if they increase that pool, the competition gets higher and the wages get lower.
And I just want to add to this, the pollution is also socialized. Then oil and gas regions themselves refuse taxes for the infrastructure and boom towns in the Permian Basin. Look at Odessa right now, a perfect example of that failure. And now they will need to be bailed out in one way. Yeah, again, it's been in the pipeline for a long time. I'm hoping it's coming out. If not, I'll find another home for it. But I've been working on a piece about the oil and gas industry in Texas. I think it's pretty in-depth, if I do say so myself. One of the things that I focus on is that question that Iris Dekup notes here, where, you know, we have a huge crisis in Texas, not just Texas, but, you know, that's the one that I know the most about, of abandoned wells. So, you know, they set up a well somewhere and then the company goes bust. Nobody knows who owns it anymore and they don't plug it up. And they're supposed to pay a little bit of money up front when they get a permit to deal with that, but it's not enough to cover the cost of plugging it up. And when you don't plug up wells, oil seeps into the drinking water, the wells can explode, and they release incredible amounts of methane, which is like one of the most damaging gases that you can release into the atmosphere, right? And it's just a perfect example, as they say here, of like the profits are private, but the costs to clean it up are socialized. And like the most conservative estimates for dealing with the abandoned well crisis, just what the state thinks, like says publicly, remember, You know, these aren't like just like nice technocrats. These are elected officials in the Republican Party. They're like, it's $1 billion. But like the more serious ones that I've seen are like $120 billion just to clean up the existing abandoned wells in Texas, right? Yeah. So it's just a classic thing. It's like they make the profits and then they socialize the costs on the rest of us.
Yeah. Also, going back to Twitch, I forgot Magitecker. Thanks for subscribing. Also, Daredevil comes back to say, I wouldn't say college is the only thing they should offer. I do prefer job guarantee. Maybe they should expand it to other government jobs as well. Jobs in renewable energy. I think like one thing this gets at is like there should be some specific promise to those workers explicitly, right? Like
totally.
Like we should just have universal healthcare or universal higher education for everybody. That includes not just 18-year-olds, but let's say like your mom and dad want to go back to college and just like get some accreditation. Mm-hmm. That should load. But like in order, the value of it is that you can go have this future life where you have a bigger house and this bigger income, right? And so like you need to just expand that to everybody, but then give people those health insurance, give people housing that is affordable. And but then like something that could be specific to those folks messaged, that is an interesting thing to think about.
I don't want to get too romantic about this because people might question my feelings about this, but like, you know, oil and gas in that industry has been extremely damaging to the environment. But that labor, as this is currently arranged, is absolutely socially necessary, right? Like as long as we live in a society that still gets around using private vehicles, as long as we live in a society that the food that's in the grocery stores uses oil to transport it to it, like that is socially necessary labor. And as like a socialist, you should want to find a way that we're taking care of those people who have been putting their bodies on the line for years upon years to fuel this society, right? I'm not saying that we need to keep it the same way because obviously we can't and we shouldn't, right? But like this is just like a debt that is also owed. And working people are owed a hell of a lot across the board. But like you got to do things specifically for that industry to make this viable, in my opinion.
We got another call here. I believe this was Kowalski from Nebraska.
Hey guys, it is Kowalski from Nebraska. I just wanted to touch real quick on the Ogallala Aquifer. I'm not sure if you got to my call from last week about it, but I never saw it, so I'm going to assume you didn't. Anywho, if you look at a depth change map of the Ogallala Aquifer, you'll see that for most of it, it is going down, except interestingly, over Nebraska, it is either maintaining or growing in many places. So there are two valleys where it is going down, but canals are being constructed. However, I think this has a lot to do with how the western side of the Great Plains had regulations around oil wells. Nebraska never had a large oil deposit, so instead of basically deregulating environmental concerns, these areas more or less double downed on them in order to have pristine hunting. And I think that actually went a long way into preserving much of Nebraska's water table. It's kind of interesting as well because places like Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas have a phenomenon that's called zero day, the day the water table runs dry. And that's something that Nebraska has never once considered just because we've always managed it better. And it does seem like any time a neoliberal governor wants to, like, try privatizing the water or something, the ranchers, the farmers, and the environmental folks from the towns all get very angry together, which is always nice to see. But, yeah, maybe we can bring some of that John Brown energy to more environmental policies. And, yeah, hey, have a good one.
I love that.
No, he's keeping the spirit alive. No, I mean, that's interesting. I don't know much about that phenomenon, but I mean, it definitely seems interesting. And I'm also happy to hear that the people of Nebraska take their land seriously enough to stand up and defend it whenever it is threatened.
You know, that's the thing I wish I had more capacity to sort of hardness or like the conservation spirit of like folks in the West. Like I feel mm-hmm. Like that's like to the extent that I experience like I don't know like that being proud of like public lands is like the one of the earliest forms of like political because like being a hunting like it's either you got public lands or you got to go butter up a landowner mm-hmm. and yeah. you see like the value of keeping a lot of this stuff pristine as Kowalski said and that it would you know have the knock-on effect of saving the aquifer is pretty profound. We got one more call here if we want to do the final call.
Or should we pepper in? Yeah, why don't we just go through them all?
And then we can, go to...
It's Strom McCallum. All I have to say is that this phenomenon with people like Walker and all of these MAGAPEDs that are coming from non-traditional Republican constituencies. It's worrisome, and I think that in a lot of things up, and I'm frankly worried that a lot of people fail to appreciate the appeal of this civic nationalist nonsense to constituencies that the Democrats think they have in the bag. And honestly, I think that if certain voter demographics are brought into the Republican camp, it'll be a lot harder to bring them to our program and our eventual party than it would be if they were in a less socially reactionary camp. So it's worrisome. Yeah, that's all I guess I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that like maybe some of the stuff that's happening in the real world, I'm not to discount that stuff is not real, but like, you know, people are organizing their workplaces, mm-hmm. and I hopefully that is the overwhelming thing other than like this new kind of reactionary. He calls it MAGAPEDs, like different sorts of folks that are learning that, you know, they're going to lesser of evil vote for Republicans for some, you know, strange reason.
Yeah, I mean, I do wonder how much of a phenomenon that is in, like, the real world versus, like, people who get a lot of pleasure out of dissatisfying people on Twitter.
Yeah.
But, I mean... In as much as like it may exist, like, you know, I always say this is like when you see the social reactionary stuff and the right wing is seeing that this is going to be very beneficial for them and riling up a certain group of voters and their base. I just have to take the position. It's like we just have to be able to beat it. Like that is so weak, like as a motivating force, as like a political program. That is something that only happens in absence of something positive, right? If like what you have to do in politics is negative, right, which is like waging war on other people, you certainly have something wicked in your soul. Don't think that I'm not saying that for a second. But we just have to be able to beat that as a movement. I'm not saying it's easy or, you know, a slam dunk necessarily, but like the only way to beat that kind of appeal is to just appeal to people on a much, much more serious level than just like punishing people you don't like, you know? And you can see that like that really obviously like, I mean, right-wing media, I mean, Majority Report, y'all do a decent amount of it in fairness, but it's not the dominant thing that y'all do. Right-wing media is almost entirely dedicated to just trashing the other side. Right, Matt? Like, you know, I wasn't making a dig at Majority Report. I was just saying that, like, you know, like their entire apparatus, like Daily Wire, like their whole thing is about like trying to trigger college students, you know, be like, oh my God, we got this person to get really, really mad at me. Like, that's their political program. And that's fucking really weak. I'm not saying it's not a threat.
Well, yeah.
Serious. It's just like, it's just something we got to be able to beat, frankly.
I mean, the tough thing is like that side wins not because of how persuasive it is, but like this country just structurally creates the like folks for that. Like honestly, yeah. Like we're talking about just the way it invests and like, just the way it invests in communities, and like yeah. It's not a shock.
No, and I mean like we're gonna talk about this in the bonus episode with C. Derek Varn, but like you know, there's not a pot like. In the Republican thing, like, apart from, like, a very vague, like, make America great again, you know, kind of thing, like, there's not that much of a positive program there, other than maybe punishing people who you think have been getting it too good. And, like, the advantage that the socialists have is that, like, when we're speaking to something material, I mean, like, it's always funny J.D. Vance goes on, all those guys go on about, oh, like, God. Oh, you know, we're doing this kind of basic social democracy with, you know, social reaction, basically. And it's always funny how light it is on the social democracy side and how much of a commitment it is to, you know, attacking folks. But, yeah, I mean, again, not to sound like a broken record, it's just, like, I think the way to beat that is just to be the real deal on delivering for people. I mean, even what we were talking about earlier with like some of the interviews in South Texas with people who voted Republican for the first time, what did they say? You know, they said, well, that stimulus check was very helpful for me. Right. So yeah. Like, that's how deep that commitment goes. And like, come on, y'all, you just got to be able to beat that. Frankly,
it's offering material goods to people. Like, how can I improve your, like, I want to improve your life, you know, versus this culture of clickbait nonsense where it's like, that makes me angry, I'm going to vote this way. You know what I mean? It's just, it's upsetting.
So we got, Kowalski says we fought the Keystone Pipeline for the safety of the water. Appreciate that. MDR, a friend in Australia, has a little update for us here. It says, in the seat of Wills, Victoria, our candidate Socialist Alliance got 3.39% of the vote, while the candidate of Victorian Socialists got 2.98% of total votes. If the other party only listened and had not run a candidate in the same seat as another socialist party, we would have had 4% of the total vote. This is significant. Parties who get at least 4% of the preference votes get their electoral campaign funds reimbursed based on formula, not millions of dollars, but still a lot of money and use for small parties. And this type of non-solidarity is the saddest thing when we're trying to build power. If the socialist leading voters weren't split, it would have at least built us up from the previous campaigns and helped out with the funding. But it was just wasted like that. That's all. Just sharing a sad story about the recent campaign and this type of short-sightedness at Left Reckoning. Well, I appreciate the chat there. And I mean, like, no, I mean, like, that. This is, like, discipline is so important for politics. And it's something that, frankly, a lot of people on the left, you know, are immune to, which is a shame. And I don't know the context in Australia. And, you know, one of the big fights we have right now is trying to wrangle up the much more vague term of progressives into the socialist movement, and like that certainly creates a lot of problems for us in the immediate sense.
Yeah. See, that's one reason I, for instance, I endorsed the DSA slate in New York.
Yeah, me too. Our friend here in Twitch says, Puddle Dive says, learning about your local ecosystems, native plants, edibles helps you open you up to learning more. Natural education has an effect.
Love that. I mean, I really think like the way you get habituated to your hometown through like the highways and stuff like that, but really it's like you're probably there because of a river maybe was there, or like and being in touch with that sort of stuff and knowing what's there, knowing, oh, there was like Bismarck, like right away when they put the town there, they're like, oh, there's some coal deposits up there. It's just like, it helps you understand like how much like capitalists even like 150 years ago created the world that you live in now.
Yeah.
There's a reason a lot of the good Marxist theorists were geographers to start. Mm. David Harvey being one of them. I'll read some Discord questions if y'all keep an eye out on the chat itself. But Joe Snuffy from Rhode Island says, I feel like we've all been staring into the abyss a lot. So to add some levity to the night, I want to know for each of you, what are your two favorite unhinged conspiracy theories?
That's oh, baby.
I think we got good guests. We got good guests here. I'm bad at this. I don't have a lot of conspiracies, but my favorite, this is from Joe. My favorite conspiracy is the Russian conspiracy theory that the Tsar had a thermonuclear bomb dropped on Moscow in 1812 following the Battle of Borodino and the Turner Diary, one that claims that the National Guard armories are actually pre-positioned concentration camps for white Christian males. Yes, people actually do believe those things.
What is that? Gary Kasparov, the chess boy,
the team, the time thing.
He thinks that like the Middle Ages are a creation of like elites.
I was about to say, yeah.
Yeah,
no, they believe a lot of wild stuff. Okay, well, on the Kasparov thing, I'm not an expert on it, so I'm going to be doing a very patchwork version of it. But just adding to you, Matt, like, one, you should – a way to tell this is a conspiracy theory is how Russian-centric it is. So basically, like, effectively what their argument is that Rome dominated everybody's imaginations and a lot of historians' imaginations during the Middle Ages. So they basically used Rome as a fill-in for like any great civilization. So like they believe that like Moscow was effectively like a lot of the things that we think about Rome was actually about Moscow. Jesus lived in like the 1200s or something and was actually like a great king in Ukraine or something. I mean, it's just an absolutely wild theory, and it's just something to remember. Other people could probably retell this better than me, but like it's something to remember whenever you see Kasparov being brought on as like a kind of expert on politics and history that he believes is absolute fucking nonsense.
Yeah, he's always like regularly retweeted by like CNN anchors and stuff like that.
And Alexander Coburn, one of my favorite radical journalists of all time, he wrote a book. So he tells a story about like how when he got his first job at the Village Voice in New York, part of the contract was you had to write a book for their press like once a year. And he's like, fuck, I have to write something. So he wrote a whole book. I've not read it, but I should. He wrote a whole book like just taking down chess as like a – like because people are always like, oh, you're a good chess player. You must be like the greatest genius of all time.
Brilliant man,
and he just like wrote an entire book just like eviscerating that concept.
Well, if you think about those great chess legends, right, like Kasparov is a great example of this. A lot of those guys, like that's the only thing that they've done since they were like 6 years old is you learn and study and play chess, and that's it. And it's associated with such intelligence and like such, you know, like that if you're good at chess, this guy must be brilliant at every other facet of life. And so they just give such credence to these people. It is awesome. And so it's even better that Kasparov is tweeting like the Middle Ages aren't real. People are just taking that at face value. That's so good.
I mean, like, I will say, like, it is an interesting theory up front that, like, you know, maybe a lot of historical events are, you know, misattributed just because, you know, people didn't have a lot of checks back then. But the advantage is that we now live in a time where we can gather, you know, firsthand or secondhand, I guess it wouldn't be firsthand, but like secondhand accounts, things that were written from places all around Europe and the world that you can construct, it's not perfect, but like a pretty decent patchwork to understand these things. So like the theory is a little bit late, like, you know, it would have been a lot stronger maybe in the 1700s.
As far as – I was trying to think of ones I believe. I mean, I believe that Kennedy was assassinated. I don't know exactly by who. Well, I mean, we all know that Kennedy was assassinated, I guess. Yeah, that's not a conspiracy theory. I believe he was assassinated by, like, CIA and folks like that. But that's not crazy. That's just facts. Leading a cultural revolution solely – what did that say?
Leading a cultural revolution solely.
That is fun.
Yes, that would rule –
I never learned chess, so I appreciate somebody taking you know, part of reason I think like we like negative culture like that reviews. It's really useful as like, oh, I don't have to waste my time with that. Which is a useful service.
Extremely anecdotal, but the most evil people I know in the world right now are big chess fans. So I feel like this guy might be onto something. Maybe we should.
So I play a little bit of chess, but I don't think that it's really a good reflection of your intelligence, to be fair.
No, it's a reflection of your ability to memorize like seven pieces moves and how they interact on a board. That's what it comes down to.
But Rob, you were stoked on the conspiracy theories. You want to share one?
Not really. I'd like to come back sometime. You know, I don't want to get immediately banned from Twitch. I mean, I love conspiracy. That's my biggest problem is I'm a huge conspiracy like theory fan, and that's why Twitter is such a problem for me because I'll just go on these like deep dives. You know what I mean? Like JFK is alive. Yeah. Oh.
Did you see the Lauren Boebert stuff?
Oh my God, dude. I have a, you know, she's my rep in Colorado. She's my representative in Congress.
Well, the thing, just be fair, like that stuff is all BS now.
So,
Did they say that nobody's going to pick up on that? Obviously, so I didn't know spurious. If it had been like debunked. Well, it kind of rocks on face value, like for me to just accept that this rules. Yeah. The theory was that Boebert was working as an escort in D.C. She had solicited Ted Cruz as a client. And then because of her expert rendition of services, these GOP members made her a congresswoman, which rules as a theory. It kind of makes sense.
Well, let's talk about the provenance of this. It comes from the same folks who were releasing all the dirt on Madison Cawthorn, is my understanding, or at least they purported to be that. Now, it's been poo-pooed. I still want to like talk through it as a plausible theory,
right? So if it was real.
She has a model. What was it? She's one of these folks. I'm putting this up now. She has a model account for what was it called? Her account owns a lot of people have this. Brandon Straka, but it is.
I'm trying to remember the name of the website. This is something I should know off the top of my head. It's like a popular thing that people that are trying to get into like modeling, I think. Explore talent.
So 34 year old Grand Junction, Colorado. Candace Owens apparently also had one of those recently. And you know, it's just to me when I heard it, I'm like, first of all, your restaurant seems like a front. You got a massive violation catering stuff, and you didn't have tongs.
That's a very light way to put. She gave 150 people like violent diarrhea,
bloody diarrhea,
from following exactly zero health. Yeah, shitters, bro.
Yes,
from no health.
It was called something like 1770. It was like the name was awesome too. Yeah.
Well, there was there's a couple different names. Because there's like the catering service, which is like the 1776 things, and then the shooters. And gave senior citizens to children bloody diarrhea because you didn't even have fucking warm holding stations for food. Just insane. And so like I'm thinking like that – if you told me that there was a Citizens United juiced restaurant – in Colorado that was like basically like taking donor money. She's an actress too. Her husband is like some total creep that exposed himself to people at a bowling alley.
That's like, not even like a theory. He has like criminal charges from exposing himself to underage women at a bowling alley like a year before they got married.
Yeah, and it's just like I could believe anything in that context. So
this lady's a lunatic.
Lauren Boebert. I mean, Ted Cruz.
Is she staying, Rob?
Oh yeah. You want to talk about like local party failures? The Democrats who control the governor in Colorado and have been nothing but inroads for the last like decade in that state, and they're letting the western slope, Grand Junction. I think it's Rifle County, and I'm trying to remember like the other whatever. It doesn't matter. But
it's a huge district.
It's a huge section of the state. Given it's not the most populous part of the state, it's a massive rural. It's a lot of farm economy. It's a lot of old oil and gas economy, like jobs out there. But they're just letting that one go. That is somebody that you could easily put anybody on the voting block, you know, who could string a sentence together and probably have a decent chance against running it, you know. And they're just letting that whole thing just shit the bed.
But
interesting. So a social communist says, Hassan described as her being an escort for somebody related to the Kochs. That person introduced her to Ted Cruz for persecuted apostates. So Ted Cruz, penis not implicated.
No, but I fucking love that Hassan tweeted this. The whole conspiracy theory is that the Koch brothers are the ones like running the great international brothel of like GOP senators, and that ruled. That's fun. That's a fun theory. Which might be probably true. You know, Kansas, there's not a lot of... Like,
you gotta tell me that giant operation hasn't paid for sex one time. They haven't paid for it once. They got all that money. Those guys haven't used it to pay for sex?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I'd be impressed.
That guy's got a $30 million wine cellar that he brags about. He's never once used that money to, you know...
Populate it?
Yeah, come on. Come on.
It's bizarre, though, that they can't beat Boebert, because, like, we had Nick Bolin on. I don't know if I sent this to you, Rob, but Nick Bolin's a really great reporter out of rural Colorado, Western Colorado.
Yeah.
And, you know, he wrote a great piece for The Point magazine about how Democrats have lost rural America. And he notes that, like, going into the challenge of Boebert, like, one of the people who was running against her was this Democrat who was like, I'm a rancher. You know, I understand what ranchers go through. And it turns out that, like, she has, like, a pleasure ranch where she, like, you know, breeds some, like, very adorable but useless, you know, breed of, Scottish cattle, right?
That fucking rules, dude. And now they're from California, like, 3 years ago.
And now they have this other guy who I don't know if he even stayed in the race so far, but I know he raised a little bit of money, who's like, I'm a gay man and I don't give a shit and I'm going to fucking take Boebert down. But turns out, like, doesn't live in the district, but his parents own like a condo, a ski slope somewhere. That's like where he's like based all of his campaign operations from. I mean, it's just truly amazing that they can't recruit any kind of real talent, there to run against Boebert at this
point. I mean, it's tough. I mean, it's a because, desolate,
like, sorry, not to cut you off, but, like, you know, this state, is your part. Like, you know, obviously you can't know everybody there, or, yeah, you know your particular part of it, but I can't imagine that Boebert is just like universally popular with folks. She barely was winning the district by like a couple points.
Yeah, I don't understand it, but I feel like her status seems to only have grown. You know what I mean? It's that whole, mm-hmm, like, no, you know, it's, I don't know. It's just, it seems like she can't do any wrong, and she's only getting more popular. It's crazy, because people, what do people in like rural Colorado want, right? They're like super into the MAGA thing. They're super into the defense of the Second Amendment. They're super into the like fight outsiders fighting for America. And they see her and they're like, oh, she's a restaurant owner. She has guns with her kids on Twitter. I like this woman. You know, it's just, it's, I don't know. I just, it's hard. It's hard to fight that cultural war in somewhere that is so deeply invested in its cultural politics.
I mean, obviously I have blinders when I go to that district. So I go to that district too.
When you come up to Durango. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, I don't know. I never feel like I'm in MAGA country. All of the extended family's lands out there, Rob.
Yeah.
Is in that district. I've looked it up, but like, I never feel like I'm in like hardcore MAGA country as all. Anyway, we might be fixating on this too long.
Yeah, but we're like, going like, just too like, deep on Southwest Colorado, like local politics.
But like, you know, it does blow my mind that like Boebert is their rep. I mean, like maybe like a typical Republican, maybe, but yeah. Boebert just like doesn't scream that part of the country to me. But
no, it's I'm wrong. It's insane.
We have something from Discord.
Just one quick thing. Maybe that shit's more popular than regular Republican stuff.
Yeah, I mean,
and that's just how
more fun. It's definitely more fun.
It generates more like fundraising, probably.
Absolutely.
Like that's which is where you know that's. You know.
Is there any like feeling in Colorado about being a native Coloradan? Like,
oh fuck yeah,
Florida. But she's from Florida. She's like classic. Like
Florida's not on the shit list. If she was from Texas or California, people would be losing their minds. But Florida is, you know, it's DeSantis country. People love them. It's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, that's a huge issue right now in the state is like the idea of like the native Coloradan versus the, you know, everybody else that's moving in. And Dave, I'm sorry to say, Texas people do not like Texans.
They seem they like me. They like me well enough, but I'll let you be the judge of that. But We're going to get some Discord questions from our friends. We are making these free, but we always appreciate our patrons. Cromulet Josh says, with regards to all the celebrities, actors, athletes who went all out for crypto, do you think this is better explained by general class dynamics, or is it more to do with specific networks, in essence, actors being represented by the same agency or a combination of both? Well, Matt has been on this grind for a little while.
Yeah, I mean, CAA, I think it's Creative Arts Agency. It has all their fucking people doing this. So it's definitely in part agency-driven. But it's also like the Warriors have a chief revenue officer, Brandon Schneider, who was the one really like pumping up their NFT holding. So it's all – it's a class thing. It's, you know, money, speculation, Silicon Valley. All this shit is fake anyway. Like crypto gets a – I feel like the crypto folks, when I listen to crypto podcasts, they're like, people are all shitting on crypto, but tech stocks are all down too. It's like, yeah, that stuff is almost like – mm-hmm. It's slightly different form of exactly the same sort of bullshit you're doing, and that's a whole lot of people, unfortunately, in this country. And I mean, I just keep thinking about how like fucking Bismarck, North Dakota, like my hometown, was. It's all speculative. The whole genesis of that was we're going to build a giant railroad, and that's going to capture this market. And yeah. There's the Black Hills there. And think about the speculative capabilities there. And it's the fucking, like, motive force of capitalism in a lot of ways. It's just all this bullshit. And it's crazy.
I mean, I'll give you the real answer on the actors front. Like, why is Matt Damon doing this? Because Matt Damon can get paid the same amount of money to shoot a movie in 60 days, or he can show up for 8 hours and do a crypto commercial, and they're getting like the same check. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's an easy decision from his point. He doesn't give a fuck. You know?
Yeah. I would do it. I would.
Well.
That's the problem with us. It's like.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why we're here.
Make my rent.
We're here.
6 hours.
Dylan says from the Discord says, random fact I want to share with the Left Reckoning crew. In the 1890s, Sioux Falls had people move there specifically to get divorced. Some of the cases were getting covered in the national press.
I don't know anything about that.
Joe Snuffy says, on my last deployment, I was serving as a part of Army Central Command's forward headquarters in Kuwait during the Trump years. The same week, the United Nations announced that 50,000 children under 8 years old had died from starvation as dysentery and dysentery. We were working on the logistics of shipping in more JDAMs for them because they were running out. Some of the younger officers connected these two things, and we were struggling with it, but all the folks in charge couldn't have cared less. If you have integrity in a soul, the institution will grind you up until you conform, until you can't take it anymore and get out. We need more Smedley Butlers.
Cool.
Yeah.
And Dave from Jamaica says, David, I'm looking forward to the piece because I'm kind of skeptical to that form of energy, talking about nuclear, due to extraction, waste control, and safety. We'll look forward to our interview with our friend Lee Phillips coming up soon. And on the Boebert story, Dave from Jamaica says, wait, it's not true? Damn it.
You and me both, Dave.
Await further reporting, Dave. Who knows? The truth is out there.
They don't want you. This is the thing. They don't
all
want
right,
you
for the record, I think it's all BS. But you continue playing the game.
It's fascinating, this fucking group, though, right? That's putting the shit out. That they got Cawthorn and they're coming after Boebert. And it's like, I know why I don't like Cawthorn and Boebert.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why they don't like Cawthorn and Boebert, unless it's like, you know, they're undisciplined and Madison Cawthorn is talking about our sex parties, which seems to be the apparent thing. But then you do this and that implicates Ted Cruz. I don't know, it's weird.
I just because and Rob did too, but I lived in DC long enough that like most of these things are really salacious. I just don't believe them up front because every fucking person, Rob, I feel like you might be able to back me up on this.
Yeah.
You go to a party in DC, there's somebody who's a staffer somewhere and they have like the most crazy dirt on this person. And I never am like, oh, I don't believe you. The thing is, it's funny, you let him go. But like, I've just heard so much BS from people. And the more juicy and like ironic that it is, probably usually means for me at least that it's probably BS. But
yeah.
Well, I mean, even with the Cawthorn thing, I mean, some of those videos were weird and like weird, like super weird and uncomfortable.
It was just
but
locker room.
Remember the first? Well, yeah, I mean, so certain locker rooms, but there, the first one where it's like, look at him with lingerie on, and he was on a cruise at like some sort of like public like burlesque. It's like, you motherfucking squares, like but yeah.
Well, that's the thing is everything of these, like every time these stories come out, it makes me like these people more. I'm like, oh, this guy,
which is very strange. Yeah. Cause these are the worst people. It's like, damn.
Yeah. I can't like, I'm not mad about the fact that they did these things. I'm like, that's kind of cool, but it's the hypocrisy of it.
You know? Exactly. Yeah.
Well, as a palate cleanser, maybe we'll, if we get any last minute on the, Twitch chat, we can throw these in, but let's go to our old friend, Mr. Bernard here. This is from his debate with Ted Cruz. And I think it's just like a good opening statement to just remind people about what good political messaging is, because Bernie really is the king at this still. You know, he oftentimes has instincts are a little bit different from me, but I respect the skill and think it's some, I'm actually not saying that as a negative. I'm actually saying it's like, there's tremendous things you can learn from Bernie Sanders' disability to stay on message on these things. But let's put this up and then we'll see if we have anything left in the chat.
What you don't hear him talking about are, in fact, the most important issues facing this country. That's what the establishment does. Lindsay is a very good and effective representative of the establishment. Does Lindsay have a concern that we are the only major country on earth not to guarantee health care to all people? That some 60,000 people a year die? Because I don't get to a doctor on time. I didn't hear much about that in that opening statement. Lindsay care that we have the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs and that the pharmaceutical industry right now has 1,500 paid lobbyists in Washington, D.C. to make sure that in some cases we pay 10 times more for the medicine that we need. Did Lindsay talk about the fact that we have in South Carolina and all over this country tens of millions of workers working for starvation wages? Did he talk about a corrupt political system in which billionaires today can start a super PAC? And I guess you have some familiarity with super PACs. They help fund your campaign. Who can spend unlimited amounts of money to elect candidates. You have the absurd situation where super PACs frequently spend more money than the candidates themselves. I didn't hear Lindsay talk about the crisis of climate change or the reality that scientists are telling us, not Bernie Sanders, Lindsay. This is what the best scientists in the world are telling us. We don't get our act together. The planet we're going to be leaving our kids and future generations will becoming increasingly uninhabitable. We're talking about great cities like Charleston, South Carolina. You're aware of that. Neighborhoods flooding. There are people who are thinking that not only Charleston, but Miami, New York City will be half underwater by the end of the century. You got to talk about that. You got to talk about income and wealth inequality. Do you have a concern that two people own more wealth than the bottom 42%? Do you have a concern in terms of corporate concentration of ownership? You got three Wall Street firms now, BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard, who control $20 trillion in assets. They control hundreds and hundreds of corporations throughout this country. Bottom line is we are moving toward oligarchy. And if we don't stand up and say that we need a government that represents working people and the middle class, I worry very much about the future of this country. And I hope you'll speak to some of those issues.
No, I don't
think you sure didn't know.
He just talks about the border. Like the border and defund the police. That's his response to that.
That whole video, every time Bernie brings something up, he's just nodding. He's like, yeah. Like the every single response is just Lindsay just acknowledging it. Like, yeah, I don't care about those things at all. It's fucking disgusting, man.
Well, I mean,
you probably like those packs, don't you, Lindsay? You like those packs with their paychecks.
He's like, yeah, sure do.
No, I mean, like, Bernie's such a winner, and, like, that is just across the board, I think, an attractive message there. You know, he's relying there on, like, the problems in this country, but Bernie backs that up with having actual solutions to this. And the thing is, like, Lindsay and those guys, like, when they debate or engage with typical, like, centrist Democratic Party arguments, like, they end up having a little bit more space than they should. Because, like, Biden's afraid of those, talking about those things, too, on a serious level. And yeah, that's why Bernie is just such an important political force still to this day, for being able to bring those up and put out the entire hypocrisy of the Republican Party now trying to pivot and present themselves as the party of workers in this country. Absolutely absurd. I think Congressional Baseball Fan has a good – yeah, there you go. Matt flexing on us. Congressional Baseball Fan says, can we create a requirement to run for president that you have to successfully throw a first pitch baseball?
Who does that disqualify?
I think it probably disqualify Biden. I would imagine that Lindsay probably doesn't have the nicest throwing arm, if I could make a guess.
Come on, Dave. Don't be like that.
But everybody, thanks so much. And thank you so much, Rob McPherson, for hanging out with us this evening. There are ways below for people to follow Rob on Twitter. He's a good man and a good follow. This weekend on Sunday, we have our conversation with C. Derek Varn coming live for y'all. We're going to be talking about right-wing populism, a subject we've been talking about a little bit tonight. Lee Phillips next week, talking about nuclear energy and much, much more. As always, support the show at patreon.com/leftreckoning.
I think I'll be doing another LEC stream maybe Friday. We'll see.
We love these LEC reckonings.
Yeah, we'll see.
So keep your eye out for a LEC stream coming up on Friday. Till then, we'll see y'all on the other side.